Good morning. You're listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott, and my co-host is Celeste Carey.
Good morning.
Last week, we began a discussion about medical care in the United States, how to improve access and care for all people. Today, we continue exploring the maze of medical care as we seek to uncover where are we as a nation and whether or not we are able to afford care for all. Joining us this morning is Dr. Oliver Fine, who is president of Physicians for a National Health Program, an organization of more than 17,000 doctors who advocate for a single-payer Medicare for all. I want to invite those of you who are listening, if you have questions or concerns about medical care, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. Are you concerned whether or not Medicare will survive? Will there be medical care available to you and to all people? Perhaps you have some questions about the way our system works today. All these are welcome, so give us a call, and we will continue our conversation this morning with you. Again, our phone numbers are 503-231-8187. Excellent.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Dr. Fine.
Good morning. How are you?
We are well.
Yeah, we're well, fair but partly cloudy.
Uh-huh. Well, great. I'm talking to you from New York City, as you may know.
And I noticed last week there was like a tornado or something in New York?
Yeah, right. Very unusual. We had two twisters, one in Brooklyn and one in Queens. Literally ripped off the roofs of houses. It was quite impressive.
Wow. Well, that's maybe a sign of the end of times or something like that.
But. Well, maybe we could look at it as a need for what would be really helpful with our healthcare system, a tornado that rips off some tops.
Well, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. The problem is that we have a healthcare system in which, you know, 62% of all personal bankruptcies in this country are due to people because of medical expenditures. So we've got some real problems.
We have some real problems. And let's start by talking about a couple of things that Medicare is. One of the things that's really interesting about it, it is a single-payer universal, not exactly totally comprehensive coverage, but single-payer coverage. The problem is it's limited to a few folks, and the problem is some of those features are limited. And when we talk sometimes about single-payer insurance, a lot of us in America act as though that's a totally foreign concept to this country, to our healthcare system. What we need, though, is universal and comprehensive coverage with that single-payer system. So now that we've kind of gotten it out of our system that's not brand new, what is it about Medicare that has been our single-payer coverage that has not permeated in the consciousness of people as a doable system?
Well, that's a very good question. I think, frankly, a lot of people have a concern, you know, that, you know, they are worried about a government takeover of health care. The fascinating thing is that they don't often realize that the Medicare program is actually a single-payer government-sponsored program.
Exactly.
So I get people who come to me and they say, don't let the government get involved with my Medicare program, right? And then I say to them, but they're the ones who actually are sponsoring it. So I think there's a lot of misinformation about, you know, how government can be helpful with respect to medical care services. The Medicare program is very popular. A lot of people in this country really depend on it, but it is those people over 65, right?
Yes.
that's when you get, automatically enrolled in the Medicare program.
And when you do get automatically enrolled, however, nowadays, originally it wasn't the case, but nowadays the case is the private sector is now involved in your health care to a point that maybe you didn't expect. We want to complain about the fact that it's a government-run enterprise. However, now with Part C, and I think to a lesser degree, depending on whether you want this Medicare Plus expanded, this is also a partnership, I guess you call it, a private-public partnership.
Right. Well, what happens is that the beneficiary at age 65 is given a choice, and, they can elect to have their entire Medicare benefit run through a private insurance company like Aetna or, Cigna. And that program is called the Medicare Advantage Program. And, by the way, it used to be called Medicare Plus Choice, but when the Republicans came into power, they changed the name to Medicare Advantage. And it is an attempt, from my perspective, to privatize the Medicare program. And there are only about 22%, I believe, of beneficiaries who have elected to go this route. Most people still stay in the traditional, single-payer Medicare program. On the West Coast, there may be more people because one of the features is that if you were in Kaiser Permanente in the past, when you got to be Medicare eligible, you might not have been able to stay in the Kaiser Permanente program, but under Medicare Advantage, you can elect to have Kaiser manage your benefit.
We're speaking this morning with Dr. Oliver Fine, who is president of Physicians for a National Health Program. It is an organization of more than 17,000 doctors who advocate for single-payer Medicare for all. Dr. Fine, as we begin our discussion about Medicare, I imagine what you encounter is a lot of misinformation or inaccuracy, such as you suggested when people come into your office and say they don't want government to put their hands on Medicare. Could you tell, and part of our discussion last week was trying to unravel our medical system in and of itself. As a physician, what is good and what is some of the challenges that we face as a country in terms of accessing medical care?
Well, we all know the real problem for now over 50.7 million Americans is that they have no health insurance at all. So we actually just got those numbers last week. Mm-hmm. They had jumped from 46.4 million up to 50.7 million, so about 4 million plus people are uninsured in 2009 from 2008. So that's one of the real problems we have with our system, but that's only part of the problem because increasingly, people with insurance are underinsured. Mm-hmm. That is to say, they have very high deductibles, they have very high copayments, such that, as I described earlier, 62% of all personal bankruptcies, that's close to 1.5 million personal bankruptcies, are due to medical expenditures. And 75% of those people had health insurance at the outset of their bankrupting illness. Mm. So their health insurance wasn't adequate. So those are two of the problems. A third, frankly, you know, is that the cost of our health care has become so enormous that increasingly businesses are finding it very difficult to offer, you know, and subsidize premiums. So they try to shift those costs, you know, onto workers.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've seen in, you know, the last decade or so, from the year 2000, you had 68% of employed Americans actually had health insurance through their employer.
Yes.
And that's dropped now 10% in 2009 down to essentially 58%. So these are some of the things that are really increasingly big problems for us in the healthcare system.
As this nation continues to debate in terms of medical care and medical coverage, certainly last year when the president proposed revision in medical care programs in the United States, there was an upsurge in concerns and rhetoric about it. And one of the things we are delighted that you are here with us is to uncover some of those myths. As you mentioned, in terms of increase in numbers of Americans losing their health insurance, and many who began with health insurance are unable to maintain it. Why is it something that your organization advocate? Why do you advocate for a single payer? Would that help to ensure that most people are covered?
Yeah, well. Number one, under a single-payer national health insurance program like Medicare, there would be automatic enrollment. You know, you present to the emergency room of a hospital. You know, they do their wallet biopsy on you and find out you have no health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is an opportunity. Let's sign you up for the national health insurance program. Is there any private health insurance company that would sign you up in the emergency room of a hospital? No way. So that's number one. Single-payer Medicare for all would actually result in a program where there were no people or very few people who had no insurance for health care in the United States. The second thing is that we think single payer would be able to control the costs of health care.
Mm.
And one reason for that is that we would be able to eliminate a lot of the administrative overhead and profit that occurs in the system now. You know that essentially the private insurance industry has an overhead on average of 20%. Every premium dollar they collect, one-fifth of it goes for their bureaucracy and their profit. Medicare has an overhead of only 3%. That means that 97% of the dollars collected for Medicare go out to pay for doctors and hospitals and medical care. So we believe that if we went from our private insurance system, multi-payer system, to a single-payer Medicare for all system, we could save an enormous amount of money. The estimate has been made $400 billion. And we could use that money to cover everyone who doesn't have insurance today, and everyone who is underinsured could get a much better policy, lower deductibles or no deductibles and no copayments.
You know, one of the things that I don't hear a lot about, except just recently in the news, a small tidbit, is the fact that single-payer insurance would also go a long way in cutting medical fraud and Medicare fraud in terms of claims. And go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you've got many different payers, you know, it is possible for there to be much more fraud, and, you know, inappropriate bills and things of that sort that just don't get picked up. But when you've got a single system, it should be much easier to do that. You're absolutely correct.
Well, I'm thinking also, and the estimated savings alone would make a big dent in any proposed expenditures or deficits that could be caused by increasing the amount of coverage that the single-payer insurance could produce.
Yeah, well, we think that actually, this whole emphasis on government deficits is really a false issue. And, you know, if we went again to a Medicare for All program, we could, do all sorts of things, get lower pharmaceutical prices, be able to deal with, duplication within the system, improve the quality of the system. All of those things would be possible under a single payer.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, More Talk Radio with Cecil and myself, Celeste. We're speaking with Dr. Oliver Fine of Physicians for a National Health Program. Join the queue here, 503-231-8187, and we have two folks here holding on. Let me get to them. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you doing?
Hi. Hello, Dr. Fine. I have a question. On the show last week, a caller who actually described himself as a single-payer supporter said that Medicare, in point of fact, was out of money, that so was Social Security. That surprised me a little because I was under the impression that both Medicare and Social Security were funded through a separate, dedicated tax, and they weren't part of the federal budget. But nevertheless, in this election year, there's a tremendous amount of talk about the federal budget deficits, and Medicare is getting blamed for a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
How would you answer that?
Yeah, very good question. What I would say is the following. The estimates from the Congressional Budget Office are that Medicare is quite solvent until about 2041. It's possible that without any changes in the taxing structure or anything, that, Medicare expenses might exceed Medicare income in 2041. But that's 31 years away. Where it's not a program that's going broke today. It is true that if we continue the high defense expenditures that we've had that have forced us to go deeper and deeper into deficit, then, in fact, there might be some problems. But Medicare itself is not going to go broke, really, or have expenses that exceed income until 2041.
What about the claim that, you have an aging population and therefore you've got, more, this is always made of Social Security, and I assume Medicare works the same way, that you've got more people paying into the, fewer people paying into the system and more people drawing on it?
The interesting thing is that if we look at some of the European countries, they have populations that are now probably 1.5 to 2 times, the number of people over 65 that we have, and yet the cost of their healthcare systems is sometimes 1/3 what the cost of ours is. So it's not an entirely linear relationship. The other thing to realize is that, the Medicare tax, the payroll tax, has not gone up since 1986, even though medical costs have gone up, certainly during that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not impressed with the demographic argument, frankly, that, we're going to have a larger percentage of people who are over 65. Yes, we will. And yes, they may have, significant illnesses. But I think that we can, in fact, do very well. And certainly the Congressional Budget Office takes all those factors into account when it says that the income and expenses will, the expenses will not exceed the income in the program until 2041.
Thanks.
Thank you, Peter.
Yes, thank you for a good question.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. Our guest this morning is Dr. Oliver Fine, and we're speaking about medical care in the United States. I want to continue a little bit in terms of the discussion, the national discussion about medical care in terms of unraveling some of the myths and some of the what is or what may be true. One of the arguments we often hear is the fear of socialized medicine and the cost. And you mentioned the European countries. One of the fears is that we might become like Europeans or Canadian and have socialized medicine. Is the care good in Europe and in the United as compared to the United States?
Well, in terms of the issue of quality, it turns out that we rank 19th among 19 industrialized nations in terms of the quality of care. And this is done by the Commonwealth Fund, which has very clear metrics for measuring quality. So it's not at all clear that our system in any way outperforms the European systems. But let me go back to the question of socialized medicine. Socialized medicine is a situation in which, frankly, the hospitals are owned by government and the doctors are salaried by government. Well, that's not what happens in the Medicare program, is it?
No, not at all.
Hospitals aren't owned by the government in Medicare, and doctors aren't salaried by government. We're not proposing that as the formula for a national health insurance program in the United States. This is not socialized medicine, and that should be very clear.
Could it be that some of the confusion about the socialized medicine and Medicare stem out of the fact that a certain amount of the Medicare payment was earmarked for paying for residents and teaching hospitals at some point? Is that a source of some of this confusion about expanding that and looking at it as socialized medicine?
Well, that's an interesting comment. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but you're right that the only program, insurance program, that supports the training of medical residents, their salaries and, that whole territory, is the Medicare program. So,
but it's a small percentage of the overall Medicare
that's
cost.
That's correct. It's certainly a small percentage of the overall cost, but it's ridiculous that private insurance companies that use, residents for, the provision of care in many of our teaching hospitals contribute nothing to the support of, the training of our future physicians.
Actually, not only do they not support the training, they don't provide any money, but that is the reason for the cost overruns. Is again, as you said, these are private or for-profit hospitals that are primarily responsible for the expansion of cost.
Yeah, well, that for-profit hospitals probably cost somewhere between 14-15% more than not-for-profit hospitals. When you look at the actual data.
We invite you to join in our conversation with Dr. Oliver Fine as we talk about our nation's healthcare system. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Are you concerned about medical care? Are you covered? Are you concerned about whether or not medical care will be provided for all. Give us a call and join the conversations, 503-231-8187. And Dr. Fine, as last year, as the Congress debated and passed a health insurance revision, I'm sure your organization was part of that of those discussions. What was good about the proposal that was passed? I suppose it's a lot like making sausage. It got so messy. We just want the final outcome. Were particular concerns addressed in the bill that was passed, and is it a move in the right direction?
Or is it really a waste of time and a smokescreen?
Difficult questions. Yes, we were deeply engaged in trying to move the health reform debate to consider a Medicare for all type proposal, and there was a brief period when in the Senate they talked about expanding Medicare to people, age 55 and above, which would have been a small step, but a very useful one. But that, the insurance companies did not want to see that happen. So we were engaged in this. What were the good things in this bill or law that's been passed? Well, the expansion of insurance coverage to a larger number of people. But, again, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that in 2019, we will have 23 million people who are still uninsured. Mm. So this was not a universal coverage bill. It wasn't a kind of situation where you got automatic enrollment. The other thing is, yes, there were some, insurance company regulations that companies will not be able to use pre-existing conditions to not offer you a policy, right?
Right.
However, it doesn't say how much they'll charge for a policy if you have a pre-existing condition.
Wow.
Yeah. And it begins to put some government money into private health insurance by subsidizing the premiums of people who are not at the income level that would make them eligible for Medicaid. You have to be really poor to be eligible for Medicaid. Well, if you're above that Medicaid eligibility level, yes, you will now be able to get some subsidies, but what you'll be able to do with that, the only thing you'll be able to do with it, is buy a private health insurance policy. So this will put money into the groups that lobbied against Medicare for All, into private health insurance companies.
So basically, what we ended up with is a government-subsidized insurance that only partially covers the people that it should primarily cover. And those people who were concerned about the government being involved in their health care are still in the dark about the fact that the government is subsidizing private industry to have care for us.
Yeah, that's very much the case. By the way, the other thing that I think people fear in a Medicare for All program is that their choice of doctor and hospital will be limited, right?
Yes.
Now, that was my next question, yes.
That's a real fear that people have. Well, it turns out if you really look at it, Medicare gives you the greatest choice of doctor and hospital. Mm-hmm. Because every private insurance company limits you to the doctors and hospitals that they have negotiated contracts with.
Yes.
And yes, you can pay a lot more to go what they call out of network, but otherwise you're confined to their network of doctors and hospitals.
And one thing we should understand, there is no such thing, or it's extremely limited and time-consuming, to try to negotiate on an individual case-by-case basis to get a doctor or a facility into that network. If they don't want them in there, they just don't get in there. And I found that out through personal experience.
That's right. No, and I'll tell you, there are many doctors, again, who feel this is really very difficult for them personally, mm-hmm. because they can't get into the network if indeed the private insurance company doesn't want them in.
We're speaking this morning with Dr. Oliver Fine of Physicians for a National Health Program. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Give us a call if you have concerns about medical care and about how we might improve it in this country. Let me
just mention also, people can go to our website.
Yes.
Yes.
That's pnhp.org.
Excellent.
Yes.
So that's a lot of information there that they can get about health care.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, let's go to our next caller. Good morning, caller. Good morning, caller.
Good morning.
What a wonderful show. Extremely relevant yet again. Can we cut to the chase for a moment, please?
By all means.
Okay. When the great debate about our health care was first discussed in the Senate and in the House, a single payer was taken off the table right away. The politicians were not even interested in talking about it. The people who have made the decisions, people like Max Baucus, the senator, and the senator Joe Lieberman from Connecticut, are totally influenced by the amount of corporate dollars from the insurance company that they get for their war chests so they could run for re-election again. Can we please talk about the influence of lobbyists and corporate dollars on our health care future? And I will definitely take my answers off the air, and thank you very much for the show.
Well, thank you for the question. That follows very well after my statement. So what about the lobbyists and their effect?
They have a substantial influence and power to shape what happens in Congress. Fascinatingly, Senator Baucus's chief person, designing the Senate Finance Committee's bill was Liz Fowler. Who is Liz Fowler? You probably never heard of her, right? Mm-hmm. Well, she, previous to his employing her, was one of the chief executives of WellPoint Insurance, mm-hmm. one of the largest private insurers in the country. So there we have it, both within Congress and then lobbying outside Congress, the private health insurance industry shaping this legislation. To the degree, there was a point at which there was a discussion about a public option.
Yes.
Yes.
That you might be able to buy into a program like Medicare. Mm-hmm. Initially, if that program were designed a lot like the Medicare program, that is to say, really run by Medicare, Lewin and Associates, a private consulting firm, estimated that about 119 million people would have signed up for this public option. Think of it. That's not just the 46, now 50 million people without insurance. Mm-hmm. It's people like you and me who probably have insurance but decided they could, in fact, do better if they had the Medicare option. Well, the private health insurance industry freaked out, spent hundreds of millions of dollars to lobby against this, such that the bill in the House that was voted on was restricted to about 6 million people, tiny group of people who were previously uninsured. You wouldn't be able to go into this public option if you had health insurance already. And then when it got to the Senate Finance Committee, there was no public option.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the influence of the private insurance industry, and I would point out, by the way, the other group is the for-profit pharmaceutical industry, who is not interested in negotiating prices for prescription drugs. And actually, it's one of the real deficits of the Medicare program. Medicare program has a Part D.
Yes.
Right? But you can only get Part D, the prescription drug coverage, if you go through a private insurance company.
Right.
You know, the entity that gets the lowest price on drugs in this country, you have any idea what that is?
That gets the lowest price on drugs?
It's the lowest price.
Oh.
It's the Veterans Administration.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because they can directly negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies for prices on drugs. If we had a Medicare for All program, and a different arrangement around Part D so that the Medicare program was negotiating directly with the pharmaceutical companies, we would be able to get much lower prices for our drugs. And that's just not what's happening right now.
We have another caller online. Good morning. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Yes, this is Kim from Gladstone. And after listening to this, I realized that this is really definitely all about money, not about care. That almost seems to be secondary. Mm. But I'm wondering, where are the highest costs of medical care in the U.S., you know, in general? You know, I certainly see, being an elder person myself, I certainly see people who have end-of-life and terminal conditions who avail themselves of medical care that won't extend their life, you know, at all because it's terminal, but they take medical care that basically is going to have them live long. It's not going to change the outcome, mm-hmm. but they are going to live longer. And how much of an issue is that in medical expenses?
Thank you, Kim.
Uh-huh. Well, it is true that you know, the biggest expense for medical care is usually in the last year of a person's life. But that would be true, you know, if the person were 30 years old or 90 years old. So I'm not so impressed with that as a statistic. It is true that, you know, you're going to find expenditures that are higher. When you talk about limiting those expenditures, then you get people saying that you're talking about death panels,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
But that never was a proposal, frankly, by the Obama administration, and it certainly is not a proposal that we would make. I think if we're going to save money in the healthcare system, it's not on terminally ill patients. It's frankly on getting rid of those administrative costs that I described earlier. You know, they're costs of having multiple insurances, mm-hmm. Having them all run by for-profit companies, but also, frankly, costs for administration in our hospitals. We compare Toronto General with a similarly sized American hospital. Three billers in Toronto General in Canada, a single-payer country, 300 billers in the similarly sized hospital here. The reason? The billers here have to deal with, you know, 20 or 30 different private insurance companies, each of which has its own regulations, each of which has its own, you know, staff to deny claims so they can hold on to money longer. That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing happens in my office. I have to hire additional people to deal with the multiple insurance companies. Mm-hmm. I'll again say it. We could get $400 billion. That's a huge amount of money if we went from our multi-payer system to a single-payer Medicare for All type of program.
We have a question here from a caller who says that they have Medicare Part A, And should they get Part B for medical?
Okay.
I'm not quite sure what they mean, but hopefully you can decipher that.
Let me describe that to you, okay, for a moment. Part A is the program that you get automatically at age 65. Mm-hmm. It covers hospitalizations.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Part B covers doctor and outpatient laboratory tests.
Right. But not medicine.
And you have to elect to get Part B, and you have to make some contribution to it, on a monthly basis. Now, you could ask yourself, why was Medicare set up with a Part A and a Part B? Mm-hmm. Well, if you go back to 1965 and you looked at the dominant health insurance program in the United States then, it was Blue Cross,
Blue Shield.
Blue Shield.
Mm-hmm.
Blue Cross covered hospitalization.
Mm-hmm.
Blue Shield covered doctor and outpatient laboratory testing. So Congress, in its wisdom or foolishness, decided, well, let's create a program that looks like the dominant private health insurance program in the United States. And that's how Medicare got a Part A and a Part B. I would say to the person who's asking this question, yes, you probably should go ahead and get Part B. And there are many different, vendors that offer Part B.
Right.
So go out and look at them, compare what they offer. Unfortunately, the way the program is structured now, you do need that Part B. Otherwise, you're not covered adequately.
Well, Dr. Fine, what's the difference really between that and still looking for private insurance coverage?
Well, in addition to Part B, you can get Part B in a traditional form.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are gaps in Medicare coverage, most people also buy a third product called supplemental coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps cover any of the deductibles and coinsurances and things that were built into the Medicare program. But Part B is not, traditional Part B is not just a private insurance company. If you want to do that, you have to go the next step to Part C,
mm-hmm.
which is Medicare Plus Choice. And then you can, in fact, elect to have a private insurance company manage your whole benefit.
Well, this discussion in itself reveals, for me at least, the difficulty we have in discussion of our medical system as it currently is established in terms that it becomes so complicated and complex. And I'm wondering if some of your advocacy for a single payer, would it cut down on the bureaucracy? Would it raise costs? How would it help not only access, but also doctors in filling out forms and things like that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It would make things much, much simpler, I think. Because from a doctor point of view and, frankly, from a patient point of view, there would be a uniform benefit package. Everyone would know what benefits you get. There would be, a uniform bill type of situation, so you could easily check up on the bills that you got, things of that sort. Medicare would be much, much simpler. In addition, I think we could really move to the thing that I would love to see is every patient should have their medical record on a little credit card-like, size card. Right now, we can't do that because health information technology is so different. Everybody, every provider, every doctor and hospital has a different computer system.
Mm-hmm.
But if we had a national health insurance program, we'd be able to have a single national system.
Well, it seems to me, I heard some of that when the health care was being debated last year in terms of access to medical information. The bills that was passed does not cover that in terms of easily access one computer system.
There's no question that the bill encourages pilot and demonstration projects in these areas, but it does not create, a single health information system through the country.
Go ahead.
I'm just reminding that we are speaking with Dr. Oliver Fine, who is with the Physician for National Health Program. Their website is pnhp.org. Give us a call if you have concerns or questions and want to weigh in on terms of medical care. Our numbers are 503-231-8187.
Now, since we've had a couple of callers cut to the chase, as they said, let me ask another question that is probably on the minds of a lot of folks. When we try to compare single payer across nations, there's the concern that other countries with single payer healthcare systems, the people don't have the same access to healthcare, that there are inequities of access as well as inequities of the quote unquote right to healthcare. Can you address those for us?
Well, there are a number of different models, in other countries. But frankly, virtually all of the Western European or industrialized countries have universal access to healthcare. And frankly, what that means is certainly they have emergency access, to emergency care absolutely equal to the United States. Where people have some concerns is that in some of those countries there may be some waiting lists for elective procedures, things like hip replacements or knee replacements. But even those things, we find, the private health insurance industry here likes to magnify, the difficulties that people have in getting knee replacements and things like that in other countries. I don't think it's as significant as many people point out. For instance, with the issue of a knee replacement, it takes me usually somewhere between a year and 2 years to persuade a patient that they really should get a knee replacement. Well, when there's a waiting list like there is in the UK and Britain, I think I would put my patient on the waiting list right away. And yes, they would probably then come up at about a year and a half to 2 years, just at the time that in this country I would have been able to persuade them to get the joint replacement. So, there are many factors that go into these the waiting lists. The fascinating thing about the UK is that you can go online, and in every, county in the UK, you can find out what their waiting list is for each of these procedures. There's no place you could do that in this country.
We have a couple of callers in about 6 minutes. Let's see if we can get those callers in. Good morning, caller.
Good morning.
Yes, your question.
My question is, it seems to me that the argument for the single payer and, the universal health care that we need, it just comes down to the money situation, because it's not like we have to reinvent the wheel, because we're the only big industrial country in the world that doesn't have free health care. So why can't, when we're arguing with the other side around this, can't we just bring it back to the, oh, you're really greedy?
Probably because that would make it a little bit more difficult for us to get that little inch, but it's a good point.
But the point that you're making, sir, is that you could indeed put a universal coverage system in place, a Medicare for all system, without it costing more than we presently pay.
Yes. Yes.
If we went from our multi-payer, over bureaucratized private health insurance system to a single payer.
Thank you, caller.
Yes, thank
I appreciate
you.
It.
And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning. Your question or comment?
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I agree 100% with what the doctor has discussed so far and the other people too. And the problem that we have, that's one of the things that's really boosting up our healthcare costs, is that we don't have everybody insured, because my understanding is, according to Dr. Paul Hochfeld of MattisHillDoctors.org right here in Oregon, which I suggest maybe you guys merge all your efforts together, is that the average person who does have a health care policy right now pays anywhere from $1,000 to $1,800 extra per year to cover all of those people.
Hello? The last part of your statement dropped off, caller.
I think we've got the general message. By the way, Dr. Hochfeld is a member of Physicians for a National Health Program. He is very active with our group as well, and we are quite supportive of his efforts to try to bring this issue to the public. Mm-hmm. And the caller was absolutely right that what's happening now is, that we have a system with extra charges, in essence, because people are uninsured. They delay care, they come in sicker than they need to be, and require much more intensive medical treatment than probably would be necessary if they had sought care earlier.
Thank you for your call. There's so many more questions. One of the things I think would be really helpful is if you would repeat your website and any other sources that you think will help give people an honest look at what single-payer insurance can provide and how they can work toward that.
Yeah, sure. Again, we are Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP.org. Another group that people could Google and get information from is a much more consumer-oriented site called Healthcare Now. They are a single-payer, consumer-oriented group.
Great. As the nation descend into another election season, what will your organization be doing in terms of the new Congress, or in terms of seeing how the recently bill is implemented?
Well, we are going to continue to monitor things. The thing that frightens us the most at this point is this deficit commission that President Obama has formed.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to make its report on December 1st, and we are very concerned that it is going to propose cutbacks in Social Security, cutbacks in Medicare, and then you have a lame duck Congress there.
Mm-hmm.
That could try to pass something that I think would be a disaster. And just think of it. They might, increase the age of eligibility for Social Security to 67.
Yes.
But then you couldn't get your Medicare until you were 67, because that's when you automatically get enrolled. There are all sorts of ramifications here, and so we're going to be working very hard to expose that commission and try to get as much public expression of opposition to cutbacks in Social Security and Medicare.
Well, thank you so much for spending time with us. We've been speaking with Dr. Oliver Fine of the Physician for a National Health Program. We appreciate your work, and we will be vigilant on this end as well.
Well, thank you so much, and keep up this kind of a program that gets the real word out to the public.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to More Talk Radio. We've been speaking with Dr. Oliver Fine, a physician for a national health program. Their website is pnhp.org. Coming up at 9 is the Omo Variety Hour, looking at how Israeli displacement of Palestinians from their lands affects both the oppressed and the oppressors. At 10 is Air Cascadia, interviews and commentary commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, Locus Focus Oregon State climatologist Phil Moult talks about the significance of recent historic floods and fires of the past summer and what they portend for the future. At 11 on Health Watch, local naturopathic physician and acupuncturist Dr. Gary Weiner discusses the underdiagnosed common condition of adrenal fatigue. And tune in to More Talk Radio next Monday at this time. Our guest will be anthropologist and author Mary Catherine Bateson. All of this here on your locally
produced
and volunteer
organized and inspired KBOO Portland.